Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Kelly Green from Claire, Harrison, Harvey, Brandsburg, and Ellers for third-party defendant below appellee Air Liquide Industrial U.S. LP. And I'm rising to introduce another member of my firm, Glenn Wiener, who will be making the argument here today for us.
Welcome to the Court.
Thank you,
Good afternoon, members of the panel. Stokes Nolte on behalf of the appellants Kathleen and William Spencer, William and Kathleen Spencer. There were four issues raised in the appeal that was filed. The first three by the appellants and then the last by the appellee Aggregate Industries on its cross appeal. The first issue that was raised in the appellant's papers was with respect to the choice of law decision that was made by Judge Babiarz below. It was appellant's position that under the choice of law analysis laid out by this court in the Travelers versus Lake decision that the most significant relationship test required an application of the Delaware comparative negligence standard rather than the District of Columbia's contributory negligence standard. And Judge Babiarz, and I think the case law all points out that the restatement second of conflicts really gives the direction of which the court should go when it's looking at this analysis, specifically at section 146 of that section and then subpart section 6 of section 146. Essentially what those sections of the restatement tell us is that ordinarily you look to the state where the injury occurred unless, as is delineated under subsection 6, unless another state has more significant relations. And interestingly enough, within the restatement, there are seven factors laid out under subparagraphs small part A through small G. And if we analyze those factors on a qualitative basis and not a quantitative basis, it's not a measurement of which who has more factors, but the quality of the factors involved, there are direct and salient reasons why Delaware has more significant relations with respect to this particular set of facts. And subpart B of Section 6 advises the practitioners to look to the relevant policies of the forum state, that being Delaware. And it's clear, as the legislature enacted in 1984, our move away from the common law theory of contributory negligence to the much more modern approach of comparative negligence. And the case law cited in our papers, particularly the decision from Judge Graves in the Judge Trucking case, that the legislature enacted a very clear and strong public policy with respect to the application of the more modern approach. Therefore, it would be, under our analysis, a clear position that the relevant policies of the forum under subsection B would point to a significant relations. Subpart C then refers to the relevant policies of other states. And here we argued to Judge Babiarz that the state of New Jersey, which is the residence of my client, Mr. Spencer, also followed the more modern approach of applying comparative negligence. We also argued that Mr. Spencer was clearly a Delaware worker.
So did you argue that New Jersey law should apply?
No, we were in trying to weigh the factors as set out by subsection 146, go through the analysis that that section of the restatement applied. And what we argued was that in analyzing the significant relations, the fact that he was a New Jersey resident and not a Delaware resident was an important point, but not one that would diminish the important significance.
Are there basically three potential choices of law, D.C., Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey?
Three potential choices, I would agree. New Jersey, because that was his residence, Delaware as the forum, and because both the defendant was a Delaware corporation and the plaintiff was a Delaware employee.
I meant four. Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and the District of Columbia.
And District of Columbia. Potentially, under the most significant relationship test, yes. We felt, however, that Delaware, because of the of the quality of the relationships the qualitative analysis was heavier weighted towards Delaware than any other state.
But of those four, only the District of Columbia has contributory negligence.
That's correct. That's correct. Working down through the list, one of the points that also bears mention is the fact that under subsection D of sums of six is the protection of justified expectations. And here we focused on the fact that Mr. Spencer, as the employee, never made any conscious decision on his part to abandon the abilities that were available to him through a comparative negligence rather than a contributory negligence. He was simply fulfilling the duties of his job. His employer told him, make this delivery, as he does on a regular basis in a number of different states throughout the day, and he did so, going to his place of employment in the morning, leaving, and returning to his place of employment in the evening. There was never an issue raised, as far as he knew, that the interests of the court's analysis would dictate a decision that would deprive him of a more modern approach of comparative negligence to that of contributory negligence. And then finally, the factor that can't be overlooked is under subsection E, is the policies of the field of law itself. And I think that this court's well aware, as again, pointing to Judge Graves' opinion, comparative negligence is obviously the more modern approach. There are very few states, I believe Maryland and District of Columbia are the two in our general area that have a contributory negligence standard. All other states.
Mr. Nolte, I get the sense from your presentation, including in your brief, that that's the factor that you weigh more heavily. Is that correct?
I weigh the highest factor, I believe, was the legislative enactment of the comparative negligence standard and the clear public policy that.
So, if the state is one of the possible, the state's having a potential interest, and it has a comparative rather than a contributory negligence statute, does that trump everything?
Not trump everything, but taken in context with the fact that we had both clear policy that is easily enforceable. We have the interests of a Delaware worker with a three-year history of litigating his worker compensation claim before the board here in Delaware.
Well, case that you rely on by Judge Graves involved a Delaware resident.
That's correct.
Who paid taxes on all governmental levels to the state of Delaware. It's distinguished from this plaintiff, who is a New Jersey resident. So are you trying to draw some equivalence between residency and simply being employed here, driving across the river?
Some equivalence, Your Honor, not a direct level. Clearly, if Mr. Spencer had been a Delaware resident, we wouldn't be here. I believe that in that instance, the case law already existing would have rendered Judge Babiar's decision moot or unnecessary.
What is the relevance of the workers' compensation plan?
To the extent that both from the fact that we've had Delaware law applied to the benefits that he's able to obtain and the fact that there is liens being asserted in this litigation, that there's a clear delineation of the parameters that Mr. Spencer was working under at the
time. Does the record show whether the is it a insurer, workers' compensation?
That's correct.
Does the record show who that is and where they are domiciled?
The trial record, to the extent that the lien was put into evidence, but not in terms of where they were domiciled, no.
If I were to begin with your oral argument and not have read the briefs first, I would have assumed that you begin as if it's a level playing field, that here are the factors, and you look at the factors to decide who has the most significant relationship. But I thought the law that we adopted was that the place of the injury is the law that applies, unless there are more significant factors that should shift that balance. Isn't that the case?
I would agree. I apologize if I didn't make it clear.
We don't start with a tabula rasa here and look at who has the closest connections. We start with the proposition someone's got to overcome the assumption that it's the place of the injuries law that governs, correct?
Correct.
And that's at least in part, isn't it, come from the expectation of the people who bought insurance to cover injuries of this kind in their own jurisdiction. Would you think that a business operating in D.C. would anticipate that it would have accidents within the boundaries of D.C. evaluated on the basis of some other state's negligence scheme rather than its own? How fair is that to the other side?
Well, to the extent that we already do that, for example, if Mr. Spencer had been a Delaware resident, I think the law would be clear that the comparative negligence standard would apply. That already happens to some extent. But to the extent that
I'm not sure how clear that law is, but I'll take your view on it for the sake of argument.
And just to go back to the first point you raised, our position is the restatement says you ordinarily look to the state where the injury occurred, and then the only reason you would depart from that standard is if you come up with another state that has the most. I think the language in the restatement clearly says it's the most. It's a higher standard, and it's our burden, or would be our burden, to overcome. And that's why when I go through this analysis of the factors in looking at what Delaware's interest is in this accident versus what the District of Columbia's was, we feel that we did have more.
It, my only point is, it sounds like your argument is that Delaware's interest and the plaintiff's interest are somehow aligned, and it discounts what the interest the defendants might have in which law applies. After all, they're the ones that are operating the premises where the accident occurred. They're the ones that are paying for insurance to cover accidents on that premises. They're the ones whose carriers are going to evaluate whether or not a claim is to be paid or not paid based upon the premiums that have been paid, with an understanding that generally the law that would apply would be the law of the District of Columbia, which would be contributory negligence. Isn't that something that comes into play, or do we have to look at this entirely from the perspective of the New Jersey resident who's a Delaware worker working for a Delaware corporation and that Delaware has comparative negligence? Why does that outweigh the interest of the jurisdiction where the accident occurred?
In using a qualitative analysis, I think it outweighs primarily because the recognized difference in the application of contributory negligence versus comparative negligence. It's a all or nothing standard versus a standard that would still allow the defendant the day.
I assume the people that make the law in D.C. are quite aware of that, and it doesn't seem to trouble them.
No. Well, I can't answer. I can't respond to that. I don't know. With the court's permission.
You're asking us to make the qualitative judgment that our view of how these kinds of cases should be handled is somehow superior to that jurisdiction's view.
Well, anytime you're going through a conflicts of law analysis, I think that's part of the process. Frankly, I think that any time a forum court is asked to perform a most significant relationship test, that comes with the territory.
Okay.
I want to, if I may, turn to the other two arguments that were raised on appeal, and that was first that Judge Babiarz, in granting the directed verdict under assumption of risk, failed to make the determination that Mr. Spencer's actions were voluntary, and the standard of review at this point would be in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. And I think the case law is quite clear that the voluntary, in order to make the analysis of whether the actions were voluntary, under the Tews decision from Judge O'Hara back in 1979, an analysis has to be made as to whether there's a reasonable alternative. And both the restatement of torts and Judge O'Hara's language to that effect makes it clear that unless there is a reasonable alternative or a choice between two evils is not a reasonable alternative. And here the facts were and I think Judge Babiar has articulated them in the transcript, that Mr. Spencer had the choice to move the pipes or to stand and do nothing. I think that analysis misses the point because, first of all, under the restatement of torts, restatement second of torts, 496E, it's a subjective analysis. It's not an objective analysis. The court doesn't get to put its decision over or above what the plaintiff did at the time. The testimony from Mr. Spencer was he was aware of the presence of the pipes. He was aware of the presence of the rebar that stood out from the concrete barrier. He was aware of the lip that ran along the top of the concrete barrier. And he even testified that at the time that he negotiated the wall and fell, he had specifically made the choice to go out the safest route he thought practical. He also testified that in his opinion, the pipes were not movable because they were stacked in an intertwined fashion. They were tangled. Given that set of facts, I think it was incumbent upon the court before making the determination that Mr. Spencer had assumed the risk that he did so voluntarily. And I think the case law and the restatement makes clear that without having a reasonable alternative, he could not have been determined to have made a voluntary assumption of the risk. And therefore, our position would be that it was inappropriate. That argument ties directly with the third argument that we raised, which was that even if the court had made a determination that the actions of the plaintiff were voluntary, it was a question of fact because there was testimony that directly was in contradiction to the judge's own summary of his decision when he said the pipes were easily movable. Mr. Spencer's testimony was quite the contrary, and therefore, at best, it was a question of fact that should have gone to the jury. This court in 1983, back when we were working under the contributory negligence standard, made clear in the Yankovich case that questions of contributory negligence are usually ordinarily reserved for the jury. This should have been no different. There was facts that the jury could have based its decision on and said that Mr. Spencer was or had voluntarily assumed the risk because the pipes were movable, or that he could have simply stood where he was and waited for someone to show up. But in both instances, whether the pipes were movable or whether he should have stood still, there was testimony and controversy to those issues. Mr. Spencer testified that the plant was a desolate place, that he had a hard time finding someone to sign his delivery ticket when he made a delivery. I think at best the issue of assumption of the risk was a question of fact for the jury. And I think that it was, as we raised in our second argument, and is part of the analysis in granting a directed verdict, the court should have made a determination as to the voluntariness of his actions, given the fact that when he had unhooked his pipes, his hoses, as distinguished from the PVC piping, the delivery hoses from his truck and thrown them over the wall, that area was no longer available, and he had to then make his choice. In summary,
what facts contradicted standing still?
His testimony that when he was there, he had been there on several occasions prior to this incident, and his opinion was that the plant was a desolate place, that there weren't people readily available to assist, that oftentimes when he had made a delivery, he would have to get back into his truck and drive a quarter mile up the driveway of the plant to find someone to sign the delivery ticket that he had just completed, that at the time when he was making this delivery, the testimony is after the fact when he fell, the gentleman from Aggregate assisted him, but he was not aware of his there's no record to show that there were people from the plant observing him during his delivery ready to assist him if he had just stood there. So the record would be that the issue is one of a question of fact.
I was trying to determine whether there are facts that compelled him to take action at all and put him in the position where he had no alternative but to take the risk that he undertook. That's what I thought you meant by standing still. I mean, he could have walked a quarter of a mile, not necessarily driven his truck.
I was referring to, I believe.
Did he have no radio or cell phone or
anything? Not, not at the time that he was inside the plant. His truck was on the other side of the wall, and I was referring to the judge's comments at page 235 of the appendix that indicates that that he could have just stood there and waited for someone to come by because Mr. Wood had come up to him shortly thereafter. And that's the rebuttal testimony in response to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
It pleases the court. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Rizzo. I represent Aggregate Industries, the defendant below in this case. This oral argument was originally scheduled in May and was postponed at my request when my partner passed away suddenly, and I think I would be remiss if I didn't take an opportunity to formally thank the court and counsel for their courtesies in that regard. The court's questions, Chief Justice Steele's questions about the form of analysis for choice of law is echoed very neatly in the record in Judge Babiar's ruling on the record on this issue, wherein Judge Babiar's expressed that very notion that what the starting point under Section 146 of the restatement is the presumption, what comment D to that section calls the dominant interest that the state where the, or in this case the district where the incident occurred, has in the outcome of the case. And that is the starting place. That was Judge Babiar's starting place in his ruling, in making his ruling. And what Judge Babiar's noted correctly was that when we undertake the analysis of the relationship that the other, the forum state, Delaware, has to this, and we look at the factors identified in Section 145, there were really only two connections. One was it's the place of incorporation of Aggregate. Judge Babiar's noted that under Delaware law, that's not deemed to be a very significant relationship and is certainly falls below the more important relationship of where the place of business is. That would, under Section 188 of the Restatement of Conflicts, Comment E specifically notes that concept.
Is there, as it was suggested by Mr. Nolte, is there a conflict in the application of the law between Judge Babiar's ruling in this case and Judge Gray's ruling in Judge Trucking versus Messick?
Conceptually, no. The approach, I think the approach taken was the same in each. Both Judge Gray's and Judge Babiar's acknowledged that the place of the happening of the incident has the dominant interest and will be the law that's applied unless there's a more significant relationship. Now, there was sort of a twist, a very, very unique and interesting twist. That accident happened in the town of Delmar and apparently right on the border of Delaware and Maryland, and it wasn't clear from the record if the accident actually happened in Delaware or Maryland or perhaps partially in both states.
Perhaps, perhaps it didn't happen at all if it's on the border, right?
What about the pendency of the workers' compensation proceeding and the third-party or the liens of the insurer? How does that play out under this analysis?
It has no relevance to this analysis. It's doesn't affect, as we look at the factors, it's not one of the factors that's considered. It doesn't affect the expectations of the parties. In fact, under the workers' compensation law, the employee has the opportunity to select the state under which his benefits he could receive his benefits. The factors that are considered are enumerated in the restatement sections. The only connections to Delaware are, number one, that were incorporated there, number two, that the plaintiff works out of Delaware. He's dispatched out of Delaware. That's his place of employment, but his work is performed not only in Delaware, but frankly, primarily in other states up and down the Mid-Atlantic area, including the District of Columbia. So his work activities.
So this workers' comp claim could have been filed in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or the District of Columbia? Is that what you're saying?
Potentially. Potentially, yes. That this employee could claim that he's entitled to benefits under the state where the incident occurred, or where his work duties are primarily performed. I won't pretend to be proficient in the workers' compensation law that analyzes the state that takes preeminence, but that potential claim is available to the employee.
Well, going back to my question, is the distinguishing fact between Judge Graves' holding and Judge Baviar's holding the fact that it was unclear in Judge Graves' case whether the accident occurred in Maryland or Delaware?
That was part of it. The other part of the distinction was that it was the plaintiff was a Delaware citizen. And that speaks to some of the factors that are outlined in Section 6 of the restatement, including the expectations of the parties. And that was in keeping with Your Honor's questions about what are the expectations of the property owner who built and maintained this property and adjusted risk based on the law that presides there, presumably, and what are his justifiable expectations, one of the important factors under Section 6. And that's a factor that's echoed in Judge Del Pesco's analysis in the Killam case, which was affirmed by this court, that the justifiable expectations of the property owner are important and a component of that. In Judge Graves' case, the part of the analysis was, well, it was a Delaware resident, and he may have expectations about his ability to make recoveries. In that case, in Maryland, there are caps on non-economic damages, and that could come into play in addition to contributory negligence. And so that went into the analysis as part of the reasonable expectations of the parties and the fact that that plaintiff was a Delaware citizen. We don't have that here. We have a New Jersey citizen who can't make that claim of reasonable expectations, we're left with the reasonable expectations of the defendant.
When the accident occurred in Judge Trucking versus Messick, Judge Graves' case, did Maryland have contributory negligence or comparative negligence?
Contributory negligence, and still does. And so that same analysis went into it. And another of those factors under Section 6, which is tied in with some of the concerns that the court raised in its question, is certainty or predictability of result. And that's certainly from the property owner, in this case, perspective, an important consideration. One could envision Mr. Spencer having a driver helper with him from Maryland who's dispatched out of that same Delaware office and comes to that same plant, and both are injured. And now we're left with differing standards of law that are applied if we follow the plaintiff's analysis, that is to say, comparative negligence if we follow the analysis of the plaintiff for the Delaware action, but a contributory negligence for the Maryland resident because Maryland has contributory negligence, same as the District of Columbia. So that certainty or predictability of result is an important consideration under Section 6 and certainly mitigates in favor of the District of Columbia choice of law. Those factors went into the trial court's correct decision that the District of Columbia law should be applied. Dominant interest of the state where the incident occurred, the District of Columbia, I should say jurisdiction where it occurred, are not outweighed or overcome by any significant relationships to Delaware. And so it was appropriately applied.
Now, your opponent emphasizes that his client is a Delaware worker.
Yes.
Not a Delaware resident, but a Delaware worker. What's your response to that?
My response is that it's true that he's an employee out of a Delaware facility, but his work activities are actually performed in multiple states and jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia. So it's more accurate to say that he works in multiple jurisdictions, including the location where this occurred. This was his fifth, at least, he confirmed a trial, it's in the record, fifth visit to this location. Each visit going over this wall four times, so it's on his 20th trip over the wall that this occurred. part of that assumption of the risk analysis. And so his work activities routinely took him to the District of Columbia. So he may be dispatched out of Delaware, but he works routinely in the District of Columbia. So I would submit that that actually mitigates as a significant, a further significant relationship of District of Columbia to the events.
On the other hand, the employment relationship is a Delaware employment relationship.
There's no question, Your Honor, that it is. And if we were focusing on one of the factors is the relationship of the party, if this was a dispute between he and his employer about the choice of law, and that would be an important because the relationship between he and his employer is centered or focused in Delaware. However, the relationship, the focus of the relationship between the plaintiff and my client is not in Delaware, but in the District of Columbia. Aggregate does not perform, regularly conduct business in Delaware, and has no contact with the plaintiff apart from the delivery at this site in Delaware. So the focus of the relationship, another of the factors under the choice of law, is again District of Columbia. When we visit the notion of assumption of the risk, the voluntariness of it, plaintiff would have us jump ahead to the moment before he falls, and really that voluntary decision happens much sooner. When the plaintiff arrives at the site for his fifth time and decides to go over the wall, and there's a reference in some of the briefs that it's 3 feet high. It's 20 inches high. When he decides to step over, he steps up and steps down. When he steps over this wall for the first of the four times that day, he had a decision. He had a choice. He knew what his procedure was, having done it four times previously. He knew what it was going to be involved. He clearly saw the condition of the wall, pipes, their locations. He had a clear path. He chose to go over that. Later on the fourth trip, he deviates from that path. The decision is then and there. The voluntary assumption is at that point, because his supervisor testified if a driver comes to a site and there's a condition that's unacceptable or unsafe, he need only call her cell number, a 1-800 number for the company. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and simply not make the delivery. And, in fact, one of his co-worker drivers testified and said that he had done that, not at this site, but at another site when he encountered what he perceived to be a dangerous condition. It's at that moment when he perceives the condition and with the knowledge of what his method of delivery is going to be and decides to go forward and makes the decision about where to put the hoses and where to traverse the wall. That's the voluntary assumption. That's the condition. That's the example in illustration 9 under comment D of 496 capital E, of the restatement on assumption of the risk. Comment D, illustration 9, talks about the sidewalk. And there's actually two illustrations. One is you've got a clear sidewalk here and an icy one here, and if you walk down the icy one when you could have walked down the clear one, you've assumed the risk. The other is there's only one sidewalk. It's blocked off, and you have to walk in the street. You have no choice. Now you don't have – that's not assumption because you don't have a choice. Very clear distinctions. We have voluntary assumption here. We have the clear sidewalk available to the plaintiff, and he chose the icy one. We cross-appealed on the notion of the scope of admissible or permissible opinion of a medical doctor to offer opinions on what is a vocational concept, disability. Dr. Boyajian was permitted to testify that the plaintiff can never work again. He admitted to never performing any functional capacity evaluation. He admitted to having no training, education, or specialized knowledge in the vocational field that could allow him to offer opinions about the vocational concept of disability. In other words, he admitted that he didn't know what transferable skills this plaintiff had, what his level of education would have, what the job market held, and what that meant about whether or not he could be employable elsewhere. He simply said he can't work again. And the trial court allowed that and allowed that to form a basis of an opinion for future wage loss. As we argue in the papers, That is deficient under 702 in terms of both qualifications and methodology. That opinion should not have been permitted. The plaintiff, who bears the burden on that issue, had the burden to establish not just physical limitations, but also how that translates into a vocational disability.
We don't reach this issue unless we reverse the judgment.
Correct.
The directed verdict judgment, correct?
That's correct. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve the balance, or I'll defer the balance to my colleague.
May it please the court, I'm Glenn Wiener, counsel for third-party defendant Air Liquide Industrial USLP. We have brought filed a brief in this matter proposing alternative grounds on which the court could affirm the judgment as to the third-party defendant should it choose to reverse as to the issue that's been argued on the directed verdict. There was a jurisdictional issue that was raised by the defendant aggregate that I wanted to address first. The circumstances were that Air Liquide, because of the grant of judgment in favor of the defendant, also received judgment in its favor below. Therefore, we had no vehicle to take an appeal to address the appropriateness of our continued participation in this case. And it has been long law of this court that alternative grounds for a judgment, and in this case the judgment in favor of Air Liquide, may be presented to the court. That is what we seek to do here, and I would point in terms of the jurisdictional issue to the way the court handled it in the Santa Fe shareholders litigation, which was cited in our papers.
But the argument that you're confronted with is that you're not raising an additional or alternative ground, that you're asking that a judgment that was adverse to your side by the lower court be overturned.
No, we were the recipient of a final judgment in our favor at the trial court. Now, that final judgment merged prior orders, for example, the summary judgment order that had left us.
What you're arguing
in
on this appeal,
yes,
however, is that an order, the order which is the subject of your specific argument, was erroneously entered. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And doesn't that have to be the subject of a cross appeal?
No, it does not, Your Honor. When you are a successful party below, and we were successful in that we got a final judgment in our favor, there is no right to take a cross appeal. You may, however, present.
There's no right to take a cross appeal. The other, your co-appellee, took a cross appeal.
I understand.
Why didn't you take one?
Because we didn't feel it was either necessary or proper to do so.
Isn't it the case that ordinarily when a party argues an alternative ground for a judgment, the specific judgment has gone in their favor?
No, I don't think that's the specific judgment here is the final judgment of the trial court granting judgment to.
No, the specific judgment is the judgment that you're contending was erroneously entered in your against your client. I call it a judgment. It's an order.
It's an interlocutory order, correct.
Right, and there was no interlocutory appeal.
There was no interlocutory appeal. We had no right to an interlocutory appeal. All prior interlocutory orders issued in the case merge into the final judgment, and those issues may be raised on appeal.
So your position would have to be that aggregate didn't have to appeal either. That's cross-appeal.
On their issue with regard to the expert, that's correct. That's correct. Take, for example, Judge Babiarz had said, you aggregate win on contributory negligence but lose on assumption of the risk. Mr. Rizzo would have been perfectly appropriate in making the argument to this court, not only was Judge Babiarz correct on contributory negligence, but he also should have ruled in our favor on assumption of the risk. I see my time is up here. If I may sum up, we believe that the alternative grounds for affirmance as to Air Liquide are appropriately before the court. and I'll defer to the brief on the merits of those issues, should the court need to reach them. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very briefly on rebuttal, with respect to the cross-appeal, I think the appellee's position simply blurs the line between testimony as to a physical disability, which is entirely within the purview of a medical professional, versus testimony with respect to a vocational disability, such as this court has faced time and time again with the displaced worker standard.
Thank you, Mr. Nolte.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.